Hey, everybody. Welcome to Therapy Rocks, a personal growth podcast. I'm your host, Signe Darpinian, co-author of No Way and the forthcoming book, How to Raise Body Positive Teens, both with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. Are you ready to let go of outdated ways of being as it relates to your relationship to money and give yourself the gift of an update? Jessie Susanna Karnatz, otherwise known as the Money Witch, is with us today, and she brings capitalism-critical, shame-free education to healers, hustlers, and creatives in order to catalyze change in their financial lives. She believes healing our finances will bring blessing to our lives, our lineages, and our communities. She offers education, money magic products, and intuitive financial coaching from the Bay Area, unceded Ohlone land, and does it all with impeccable business lady style. Jessie Susanna, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
I have to say that I thought I was a bit more awake and aware of my relationship to money than it turns out And I just finished scouring Money Magic, and I have writing all over in the sidelines, and I just really dug in, and I feel so much more awake and aware now than before I read the book, and I thank you.
Thank you so much. It is so special to hear feedback from early readers, and it's just like truly thrilling to interact with you and hear the reflection.
There are just domains that I had not even thought of. I treat food issues, eating difficulties, and so I'm really used to how much you can learn about somebody and about yourself as it relates to food, something that you have to do daily and almost, you know, every few hours. It hadn't occurred to me that money is so similar, something that you have to deal with daily, almost hourly, and how much we can learn about ourselves.
Yeah, it is one of your most consistent relationships. You really have to interact with it, like you're same with food, every few hours.
Right. And it's just interesting how unaware we can be about what's happening with that relationship.
I think because it just can feel mundane.
Hashtag boring self-care.
Exactly.
Can be. Not the way you do it, though.
Aw, thanks.
Yeah. And, you know, I noticed that right in the beginning of the book, you stated right up front that this is not a law of attraction book, otherwise known as LOA. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about law of attraction and why that's an important distinction?
I can tell you a tiny bit, but to be honest, I have never and don't really mess with law of attraction very much. It's a sort of spiritual belief that, you know, the way to bring money into your life has everything to do with your vibrational center, and that, you know, if you are not attracting enough, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
you're just attracting wrong. You're vibrating wrong, I guess. So my specific disinterest in law of attraction, although I do get very woo and I love, you know, magic and manifestation and, you know, vibrational medicine and all those things, is just that it is, you know, spiritual bypassing, very love and light, kind of toxic positivity style, in that there's no addressing of structural inequality within the law of attraction mainstream world that I have ever seen.
Can you give an example of that missing piece? So if not LOA, then what? How would it look considering the structural piece?
I think that for me, always about complexifying the situation and validating the structural impact. So if, for example, you are not making enough money, you know, to pay your bills, instead of it being strictly based on you and, you know, you're not manifesting, you don't believe enough, you're not manifesting high enough, to really validate that there may be racial, geographic, gender reasons that are impacting your access to finances. like the entire system of structural inequality, colonialism, capitalism is all based on an economic caste system, or a caste system that is propped up through economics and finances. So to not consider the impact of that on an individual person's finances would be, I mean, truly ridiculous, really.
I remember back in the day when I was really into law of attraction, and I started to get a little cuckoo for cocoa with it. I just had this one epiphany where I'm driving down the freeway and a rock hit my windshield. And I just took it so literally. I'm like, I did something so bad that I drew a rock in. And I'm like, you know what? Time to maybe just kind of back off from this paradigm a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like there's like three things, you know, because there, I feel like there's energetics, there's structural inequality, and then there's just randomness.
Right.
You know, like there's just a random quality to the universe. So in that particular instance, I feel like all three of those things are maybe intersecting, right?
Right.
It's like, yes, maybe, you know, you are on your own individual spiritual journey, and maybe there was some sort of purpose of that rock in the windshield. It's, you know, to wake you up or to make you realize, you know, you need to have money set aside for random expenses in case something happens, and you can't like always be, you know, riding it so thin. Or, but also it's like just a rock.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also it could be like, you know, how well are the roads maintained? What does that have to do with like where you live? What does that have to do with who lives where you live? You know, where are the geographic and city planning resources being distributed? Like all of those things play in that situation.
That's such a perfect example. Are there some examples of scary things that you've seen surface related to financial healing?
Sure. I call a lot of what I do financial shadow work. Mm. And I think, you know, when you're in the shadows, the same things that are in the shadows, whatever door you take to the shadows, it's like the same, you know, there you are, wherever you go, there you are, right? So I think shame and grief are probably just like massive and sort of umbrella terms for other little things that you might see. Also self-sabotage, self-neglect, you know, perpetuation of cycles of neglect is pretty major. Privilege, people don't want to look at it.
Why do we have so much shame as it relates to our mistakes, our perceived mistakes with money?
I think that the colonial mindset in the United States especially is that your worthiness is connected with how much money you have. And there's a bias, a subconscious bias, sometimes a conscious bias, that the more money you have, the more virtuous, the more intelligent, the more successful, like there's something, you did something right, or your family did something right. You know, you know something other people don't know. You're, especially, you are prudent, right? You are restricted and limited in the way that you manage things. And I think it's very puritanical, but the equation on a subconscious level, I think, is there. And even though most people, I find across class background, most people say to me, you know, because I was raised XYZ, literally anything, I wasn't really taught about how to manage money. And yet somehow we feel like, or we're expected to, I mean, and like we said, you have to, because you have to interact with it so much, to have some sort of management skills. So I think sometimes there's like this feeling, somehow it's inborn or inherent that we would know how to manage money. And if we don't, then there must be something wrong with us. I see it even with small business people and their bookkeeping. Like people kind of feel like, oh, I don't really know how to, you know, be the CFO of my small business. Like something's wrong with me. But I'm like, why would you know how to do that? It's a skill set that you have to learn. It's not like people are just born knowing how to do bookkeeping. But I think maybe because it is so basic and so kind of human to have to deal with money, we feel like it should be more intuitive than it is. In addition, most people do know on some level that they are avoiding a certain number, like avoiding getting face to face with their kind of like self-destructive habits or, you know, whatever, that they're out of integrity in their financial life on some level, right? So that's like that sneaking suspicion that you are out of integrity in your financial life.
It's quiet, but it's there. Mm-hmm. There's this one exercise in the book that really struck me, and it was about taking one step forward and experience healing by identifying one financial or administrative loose end from your past that you have felt ashamed of and make a plan to clean it up. Mm-hmm. Sounds like this little exercise. And it's interesting, a few months ago, before even discovering your book in Bust Magazine, I cleaned up one little financial loose end that had been eating at me in a very, very subtle way. And it was the weirdest thing. And I kept thinking, I kept tweaking the facts of the situation to match my feeling and just kind of avoiding it. But it just wouldn't go away. It just kind of kept eating at me and eating at me. And finally, I just dealt with it. And then I read this and it was so validating. I'm like, just one. I like how you say, choose one bite-sized project. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I truly believe, I mean, avoidance is massive in the world of finance. And I think people feel like they're doing themselves a favor by letting themselves avoid their finances because it's sort of like, well, you're dealing with all these hard things. Let me just kind of give you a break and you don't have to deal with that. But you actually never don't have to deal with that because it does eat at you. I don't think it takes less psychic energy to address your finances than it does to manage the low level anxiety.
Yeah.
And sometimes I definitely hear it from clients where we've done back tax projects, like cleaned up years that they hadn't filed. And people often say, I didn't totally realize the magnitude of how stressful, mm-hmm. like how much that was stressing me out on a subconscious level until it was handled. Now I feel really, I feel really relieved because we can talk ourselves out of things like, you know, going to the tax example, say you had a year of taxes from 3 or 4 years ago that you hadn't filed, but you filed everything before it and you filed everything after. It's just a little loose end, right? Mm-hmm. And it might have been like, well, you keep telling yourself, I probably didn't make enough that year to file anyway, so it's fine. I haven't got anything from the IRS, so it's fine. You know, it's like, let's just let it slide. But it still bothers you. It really does bother people. Yeah.
It really does.
Handling things. The other thing I think is the impact on your self-esteem. Self-esteem is massive. Like financial self-esteem is massive. And so you're observing yourself repeatedly justifying, avoiding not handling something that you know could put you in danger. I mean, you know, to some low level extent, or that's making you stressed out, but you're watching yourself over and over, like not handle it. And I find for myself to understand my relationship with myself, like what does self-love look like? What does self-esteem look like? It's very helpful for me to look at what that relationship would look like if it was external, like a two-person relationship. And so I think it's the same thing, like, you know, if your best friend was just like, if you had listened to your best friend for 3 years, you know, every few months, be like, oh, I really should file that tax return, it's stressing me out. After a while, you'd just be like, can you just shut the fuck up and mm-hmm. file the tax return? Like, and you would kind of get this, you'd be like, I love that person, but like, they really don't handle their business. You know, so there would be a little thought about it, right? And just like, you know, if this thing's bothering you so much, why don't you just handle it? Obviously, there's some reason you don't want to handle it or whatever, right? Like you would have this esteem. That's the esteem of the other person that you would have. And so you're kind of gaining that opinion of yourself. It impacts the way that you view yourself and that you, I don't know, just the esteem in which you hold your own behavior.
You know, actually, I'm glad you brought up the definition of self-esteem in the book, because I feel like, well, actually, I know that I've read a lot of self-help books over the years, but I've never really found a definition of self-esteem that appeals to me, or like how to improve your self-esteem. That's the first time that I ever read a definition of self-esteem, and how not dealing with your financial, say, like tying up loose end, for example, affects self-esteem. That's the first time that it really kind of came together for me.
I credit my therapist. Therapy does rock.
Well, yeah. Thank you.
Yes,
yeah.
I credit my therapist for that, kind of indirectly, you know, for being the teacher in that. And I think I even tell the story in the book that I was going through this breakup and, you know, I don't remember exactly what I was dealing with in the moment, but she was like, you know, you're also in a relationship with yourself. And you're like, wah, wah, wah. I'm also in a relationship with myself, you know, like, and she's like, no, you're observing yourself.
Yes.
Act. So you have to act, you know, because I think I was like, oh, should I do this with the, you know, should I go process with this other person or something? And she's like, you have to, it's not about like what they think, how they all feel, whether they deserve it, any of that. It's like, if you go to do that, like, what do you think? Like, if you observe yourself going to do that, how will you feel about yourself?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh, yeah, I am in a relationship with myself.
In the book, you also talk about the importance of a self-awareness audit.
In the book, the self-awareness audit is kind of the internal piece that would go along with a sort of practical audit as well. So I kind of would recommend doing the practical audit of where you're at first, because that might, you know, activate more of the emotional threads. So that would be kind of like, you know, where are you? How much are you bringing in per year? What's your savings look like? What's your debt look like? What's your student loan debt look like? You know, what are you saving for retirement? Do you have any assets? What are they worth? Those kinds of things. That's the sort of practical side. And then the self-awareness audit is like, you know, just number one, how do I feel about that information?
Okay.
What value do I assign to that information? You know, me making this amount of money per year, what does that mean to me? Does it mean I made it? Does it mean I'm making more money than anyone in my family's ever made, but I still have, you know, $20 in my account and I feel ashamed of it? Does it mean I'm not making as much as I thought I would at this age and I'm like, you know, I'm a loser, what's wrong with me, right? So there's that second layer. How do I feel about the information that is true in the moment? And I think then also noticing what habits and behaviors you consistently engage in. So where do you see, I don't know, some blocks or some concerns? Like, what are you worried about in your financial behavior? And then always, always, always just digging deeper. Like, what is that? Why, you know, why am I doing that?
In the book, when you talk about taking a look at your family's outlook on money, is that part of the self-awareness audit, or could that be a part of it?
Oh, absolutely. We feel very bound generally by our family's relationship to money. It's one of the last areas I think that people feel free to be different in. So, you know, we might make choices to, you know, parent differently, to get a different kind of education, to dress differently, to have a different type of relationship with eating, or different, you know, I don't know what you call it when you're a vegan or something like that,
yeah.
Right? You know, to decorate your home different, or to, you know, whatever. There's so many things that we're like, yeah, I'm going to do this different, to move to a different geographic area. But money is not one that I think people feel a lot of authority to say, let me really define my own relationship. Mm-hmm. I have the right and I have the information. I have the intelligence to define, you know, redefine my relationship to money. And I mean really redefine, because just being in kind of blatant rejection is also a type of being bound by your family's money story, right? Like that's adolescent. There's like compliance, which is kind of more like small child. And then there's like, you know, extreme rejection, rebellion, which is like a bit adolescent, right? Teenagery. But it's really about finding something that is more mature than both of those things. You know, when in an intuitive financial coaching session, when we get into people's families, I'll usually just start very simply with the question of like, you know, who raised you? Like write them down. And then what are each of those people's, what would you say their philosophy on money is? Mm-hmm. You know, what did you hear? What do you remember growing up? Like any little phrases, you know, whatever it is, sure. Whether it's like money doesn't grow on trees or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you better, I don't know, you better marry rich because you have expensive taste or whatever it is, people's little things, you know? So, because those, there's a lot of knowledge. There's a lot of self-knowledge to be found. You know, there's a lot of gold within, self-awareness gold within those just short quips or definitions.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, yeah, actually I do that. I, you know, I can see how I really am mirroring that in some ways.
Yeah. And in one section, I thought it was interesting, you know, after you've done this work and you have a good foundation, if you had a person that you felt very safe with, asking them, how do you see me with money? You know? And so that got, and you know, I'm just at the thinking about it stage, but it got me thinking about, gosh, we're pretty aware of other people's stories with money.
Yeah.
You know, it comes out a lot in the way that they just speak about things in general.
Or just the way you see them navigate, you know, how do people act? You learn a lot about money. How are people acting around money just by like going out to dinner with them?
Oh, sure.
You know, anything.
Yeah.
Being friends for a couple months. You can just sort of observe like, how do people treat themselves and, you know, treat their material objects and engage financially in the world. There's just a lot.
Yeah,
there's a lot.
Oh yeah. I've been thinking a ton about it. It's fascinating. Okay. So after we've taken an honest look at our lives and our behaviors and we've dug deep to figure out how we'd like to show up differently in our finances, what would be the next best actionable step?
Well, the book follows what I call a 7-step system for healing your finances. So in the book, I think of the system that it could be used to heal anything truly, but we just happen to be talking about money.
I totally felt that. Yes.
And none of it is groundbreaking really. You know, like it's a very basic just kind of like, okay, where am I at? Where do I want to go? How do I get there? You know?
Yeah, but it was it felt pretty groundbreaking to me. It was very unique. It was it wasn't like anything I've read.
Thank you. Yeah. I think that, you know, the path, I definitely think of it like a journey. The visual that resonates the most with me, I don't know if you have any children in your life, but it feels very like much like a Dora the Explorer episode. So, you know, she's always like, I have to get from here to there. And there's going to be these three, you know, it's very like hero's journey. There's these three things I have to overcome and I need to have the right tools to do it. So for me, the self-awareness audit is really just an assessment of like, where are we now? Mm-hmm. And then figuring out where do you want to go is the next step, right?
Like, would that be the desire? We're figuring out your desire?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So first, with the self-awareness audit and the practical audit, you are awake, you're much more awake and aware of what your current relationship is to money, which then gives you more of a choice to do something about it.
Yep.
Then it's the desire, figuring out your desire. How would you like to be showing up differently? What do you desire?
Yeah. And where do you want to go, truly, yeah. because I think so much of our desire is either shaped through, you know, kind of consumption, right? Consumption mm-hmm. culture, materialistic culture, or it is deeply limited by our self-belief and the belief that has been fed to us, depending on like where in our kind of, you know, racial and class caste system we are. And then it is impacted by our politics and kind of, you know, the way that politics and internal shame and guilt around privilege play into our beliefs around money. And I think a lot of people aren't actually very in touch with like what they would really want. What would you really want? You know, but I think figuring out a destination that you truly want to arrive at is a much more, like, it's much more motivating to get on the road, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think this had to do with the intentions, you know, mm-hmm. that you might set after recognizing or realizing your desire. Mm-hmm. And I love the quote, get out of my dreams and get into my car.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So I'm like, that is brilliant.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Like, it's just like, you know, make it happen. I have I'm an astrologer. There's some astrological, you know, points in the book, and I have heavy Aries energy. So I'm just like, go, 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 go. You know, I'm a go, go, go priestess of the go, go, go. Not necessarily in a like don't rest way or like grinding kind of way, but just the like, you know, spark of action. And once you get excited about the possibility of truly being able to arrive where you would want to be, it's like, yeah, get into action, because like, let's go. Cause there's the excitement. It's not something you're doing for other people. I think a lot of our money behaviors are things that we are actually doing for other people to be a good person, to, you know, prove something to our parents or the IRS or the bank or, you know, just be some sort of weird definition of like upstanding adult that we have created for ourselves.
We would need a part two for the more actionable
items.
But so I see that in our future. But one piece that I would not have thought of, and that you know, you definitely thought of every angle, but financial codependency.
Oh yeah.
I mean, when I read that section, I really didn't realize how often I see that in my caseload as a therapist. In my personal life, and in all the different ways that financial codependency can show up. Can you say more about financial codependency?
Sure. I mean, it's so funny because it reminds me of the thing where it's like you read the fortune cookie and then you say in bed at the end, because I feel like if you just put financial in front of almost, you know, you're like, it's a thing. It's a different thing, right? Like we're like financial self-esteem, financial shame,
totally.
Financial codependency, financial gaslighting. We talk about that in the book,
totally.
You know, and they're all very real, legitimate phenomenons when you like dig into them. So financial codependency is the way that we give away our power by, I sort of think of codependency as sort of like being like pushed around by the wind a little too much, you know, a little too movable, not being fully kind of anchored and grounded in who we are, what we need, what our limits are, what our desires are. So it could come, you know, I mean, a very kind of light example would sort of be succumbing to peer pressure, although people might not even realize they're pressuring you to spend money that you don't have, you know, to go along with an experience. Oh, my so-and-so wants to go to this concert and I don't want to say I can't afford it, or, you know, I know it'll make them so happy. So like, let's just, you know, I'm going to go, or, you know, there's an expectation that I'll contribute money to my family in a way that, you know, I maybe have the cash flow to do, but that would mean if I had continued that level of expectation of giving, you know, for my whole life, I would have no retirement savings at the end or something like that, you know? So those are examples. I think definitely it's complex and there are different cultural expectations around interdependency around money, right? And, you know, I mean, obviously you're a therapist, so it's like there's codependency and then there's interdependency. So it's not about, you know, walling off, financial hoarding, everything, you know, rugged individualism. It's not about that either. And there's definitely space to respect any level of financial interdependency that feels, you know, personally desirable or culturally expected or appropriate for you. But where are the places in which you need to set limitations or you need to have boundaries and that doesn't feel like an option? So something I see come up in that particular instance a lot is that people will develop these workaround financial habits that are actually a bit sabotaging, like self-sabotaging, rather than feel entitled to have a boundary with family. So two examples I could think of off the top of my head is a client who is sort of feeling, you know, she's in her early 40s and she's kind of not quite ready to take on the familial expectations of sort of being an established adult in her family who will be like responsible kind of for a larger family internationally. And so she's like not making as much money as she wants to make.
Oh.
Because it's like, well, if you don't have it, you don't have to give it.
In the position.
Yeah, exactly. And another person who was making, you know, decent money, kind of like mid-level, like nonprofit manager money, and was, instead of saving, which he wanted to do, he wanted to save money because he wanted, you know, and even if you don't actively want to save money, if you want to do something like buy a house or, you know, those are things where it's like, yes, well, you should, you know, on some level you do want to be saving money. So, but instead of saving money, he was shopping a lot, like buying himself a lot of things. And when it came down to it, it's like he was buying things for himself because above and in a way that was a little self-harming from like a savings perspective, because it was a way that he could ensure that that money and the work that he had put into that money was going to him. Like, it's for me, you know, I'm getting to reap the benefits and I know that I'm getting to reap the benefits. And then I can just say, I don't have the cash if somebody needs something, because you don't have the cash flow. You've already spent it on something for yourself.
So then he doesn't have to feel guilty about saying yes to something that he really wants to say no to.
Yes.
So instead of just getting comfortable with saying no, easier to sabotage.
Exactly.
So interesting. Mm-hmm. And I really like your definition. Codependency may manifest as protecting people from the natural consequences of their actions.
Yes.
Yeah. What are people afraid of?
In codependent patterns, often people are afraid of losing love, losing validation, feeling less loved, feeling less important, feeling less needed. They're afraid of being confronted with what might be a subconscious concern that they're only being loved or being valued or being kept close because they're able to do something, right? Like provide a certain skill or resource.
That's a big one.
Yeah.
Does it have to do with the other person? Afraid that if they take the resources away, then they're not going to make it or...
You know, yes, that, you know, that can be one too. And that's a very hard one, you know,
that's
for people who have been in a close caretakery position with someone who you truly felt like might not make it without you, and then needing to be like, if that is the case, then maybe that might be the case right now. Yeah. You know, like sometimes it does come down to that. I also think we're often in codependent situations afraid, especially when it comes to financial codependency, afraid of not getting our own needs met, because I think sometimes in codependency, we're setting someone else up to be successful enough to meet our needs relationally. You know,
that's like interesting.
We're like, oh, well, you know, I don't know what
sort
it is.
Sort of like an extension of yourself in a way.
Yeah. But instead of just making the expect, I mean, and really then what we're afraid of is relationship loss, right? Mm-hmm. Because if mm-hmm. you're going to say, I can only, or I'm only going to be in this relationship, a lot of times it's maybe a romantic relationship, right? So I can only be in this relationship if my needs are getting met. And I have a need to, I don't know what, like feel like things are fair and have my partner pay half the rent at the house. But then in order to make that happen, I am like constantly being like, you know, reminding them, oh, you need to go to this audition or get this gig. And, you know, did you do your bookkeeping or, you know, pay your estimated taxes or, you know, don't forget to whatever, so that they'll have enough, like you have to kind of be that caretaker in order to make sure they have enough money, because really what you're trying to do is make sure they have enough money to pay their rent so that you don't feel like you have a partner who doesn't do their share.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, codependency is so twisted.
I mean,
really.
It's so twisted. And even thinking about financial codependency looking like generosity that's designed to control.
Yes.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely, you know, people who feel like they have to buy love, right? Mm-hmm. That is like one form that can take. I feel like it can happen in family relationships, like family of origin relationships, where maybe the, you know, depending on what your family unit looks like, it can go either way. But maybe the, you know, parents are still helping you pay certain bills, but then that makes them feel like, well, then they are entitled to have an opinion on the way you do certain things.
Sure.
Or, oh, we're going to pay for this, you know, trip, so then you need to come to this dinner wearing this outfit.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. All the angles. Jesse, Susanna, thank you for inviting us into what you call one of our most intimate realms, the realm of money and survival. And for reminding us that the work of healing our finances is the work of healing everything.
Thank you for allowing me to journey into this intimate realm with you and all of the listeners. I really don't take it lightly. I know that it is a very, even just engaging in the thinking, allowing me into your thinking space around such an intimate topic is very intimate. And I really hold that as an honor and hold it very tenderly. So thank you.
Thank you for joining us today for another episode of Therapy Rocks. And a reminder that you can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And feel free to contact me with questions at www.signadarpinian.com.